So first of all, I want to tell you something about my own experience of death, or some of my own experience of death. So my first experience of death, when I was about seven or eight, I think, I used to live, I was born not very far from here. I come from a small village in Warwickshire, not very far away from here. And I've got a very chaotic family, that's a whole other question. And my grandmother used to live next door. And my grandmother had a special fondness for me. She taught me how to draw a swan. She could draw it without, you didn't lift the crayon off the pad. Actually, it was the only thing she could draw. And she taught me how to draw a swan. And I remember I coloured in a goose, and I didn't go over the lines, and she was very impressed with me. We had this sort of bond, my grandmother and I. I used to run round every morning after getting up and just spend the day with my grandmother, who always wore black. She'd worn black since her husband died 40 years before, and she always wore a hat. She said she felt like she was like part of another world now. And she died when I was about 7 or 8. And unusually, my mother suggested I come say goodbye to her. One of my brothers and I went over to see her. And I've just been thinking about it, particularly recently, for some reason it's come back into my mind. And she was in her coffin on the bed. And just being in her bedroom was very strange. I don't think I ever even went upstairs. She just seemed to live in one room. So just even being in her bedroom was strange. And you know that experience when you're very young, I couldn't work it out, but there's this sort of strange atmosphere, this sort of strange sense of something in the air. And my father's voice, it was a special voice that he kept for solemn things. He only used it about twice a year. It's a very particular atmosphere. And she was lying in her coffin, and I remember going to look at her. And my mother was saying, "Oh, now you say goodbye to her." And then my mother was saying, "Well, she's gone to a better place." And I didn't see any evidence of that. And then she said, "She's asleep. She's asleep. She's just asleep." And even at that age, I remember very clearly thinking, "No, she's not. She's not asleep. No." And I knew that my parents were trying to protect me from something. And I remember looking at her, thinking, "She's definitely not asleep. I don't know about the better place. It doesn't look to me like she's gone to a better place." Looking back on it, it feels like the air was full of a question mark. And that question mark is still with me. It's still with us all. But it felt, my metaphor for it that I could think of it, you know that experience when a moth is flying around a light and it kind of agitates the whole room? It's as if the whole room was agitated by a question. And the question was her death, lying in this box. I've been so close to her, I'm so fond of her. And then she looked so unlike herself, being dead. And what did it mean? She wasn't asleep. And then 15 years ago, my father died, about 15 years ago. I'm very pleased to say that I'd grown fonder and fonder and closer to my father. One of the things I think the Buddhist practice does is it draws you closer to your family. I had a very difficult relationship with my family when I was younger, particularly my brothers and my father. And I used to feel when I was a child I had this sort of ongoing fantasy that I was adopted because I'm so different. I felt so different from the rest of the family. I thought I might actually have come from another planet or something. Actually, I'm just like my brothers, actually. That's another matter. And I was on a weekend retreat. My father was ill for a while, and I was on a weekend retreat I was leading, I think. And I went back. I was ringing up, and my brother said, "He's really, really bad. I think you should come back." And I remember being given a lift to the station and this awful panic. I sort of knew he was going to die. This awful sort of panic that I had, you know, that sort of, again, that moth flapping around the light. I went home, and my father was dead by the time I got home. In fact, I remember this particularly grim moment when I was ringing from the station on the way, I think from Peterborough or something, because it was no direct trains. And my brother was in tears, which I've never ever heard my brother crying. It seemed unimaginable. And him saying, he's just died. And I got home, and there he was, lying in the lounge, which is, you know, unusual enough for my father. I don't think I hardly ever saw my father lying down. And I sat next to him, you know, and I've been a Buddhist, obviously, for many years by then. And I sat there with him. I sat there for quite a long time. I sat with my mother for a while and she went upstairs. And it was just my father and I. And I was doing a mantra, I think. And I really thought, I don't know what's happened. I wanted to say, Dad, I don't know what's gone on here. And you can't talk to me anymore about it. The only thing I could definitely know is that I couldn't talk to him anymore. But I didn't know anything else, including that I didn't know whether he'd died in the way that we think of it. In that moment, I really just didn't know. And it was probably one of the deepest didn't knows I've ever experienced. I just didn't know. I didn't know what happened. I didn't know. I've never felt that quite so strongly. I just remember saying, Dad, I don't know, I can't talk to you anymore. It felt like he'd gone into another room and the window had misted up and I couldn't see him anymore. But I couldn't think of him quite as dead in the way that we think of him, think of people as dying. I didn't know that. It wasn't there. I didn't either know anything else either. I just didn't know. Yeah. So I don't know what happens when you die, and I think we don't know. None of us know. People say they know, but they don't know. They believe they know, but they don't know. And I don't know, and I'm not intending to suggest I do. In fact, I think there's something extremely valuable about actually getting in touch with that don't know, rather than in our pretend don't know, which is really think that they've died in the way that we think of it in the West, which is a nihilistic assumption based on lack of evidence, really, based on a kind of modern prejudice that we sometimes rather pleased with. But we really just don't know. And in that moment, I felt that very clearly, that I just didn't know what had happened. And I still don't know what's happened. So if we don't know anything about human death, we certainly don't know anything about the Buddha's death. We don't usually talk in terms of the Buddha's death, we talk in terms of the parinirvana. Nirvana means enlightenment, pari means something like without remainder. So it's usually translated as enlightenment without remainder. So he had enlightenment when he was enlightened, and then you have enlightenment without remainder. The remainder is the body. So you've got enlightenment with a body and then enlightenment without a body. So that's another mystery again. And I think death itself is the greatest mystery. So it's a mystery beyond the greatest mystery, what the parinirvana really means. If we don't know what happens to us, we certainly don't know what happened to the Buddha. I think more and more, we've done the Buddha's life story on this retreat many, many times, and I never tire of it. I find more and more in it. It seems to me to be the archetypal pattern of human growth. It seems to me to be the undersong of life. And that the more my life corresponds to that undersong, the more my life is fulfilling, satisfying, enriching, and the more my life has benefit for others. The further I'm away from that undersong of archetypal evolution, of archetypal spiritual growth, the more my life is unhappy, ineffective, and doesn't help other people. So you can think, I think, of the Buddha's life as an exemplary spiritual life with all the elements in which any spiritual life needs to go through, even if the details are utterly different and imaginably different in the 21st century. But somehow there needs to be a chiming with the going forth, there needs to be a chiming with all of those great stages in the Buddha's life. That's really what human spiritual growth is. Yeah. And similarly, his death is an archetypal death. It's an exemplary death. The Buddha, you could think, is the exemplary life, which we're always trying to get closer to in our own life. And the Buddha's death is the exemplary death, which we're always trying to get closer to in our death. So I want to really mainly explore one image, really, just the Buddha dying. I could say a lot about the period before the Buddha died, the last teachings he did. He became ill. He was teaching in northern India, walking the dusty paths of northern India with bare feet as an elderly 80-year-old or something like man, teaching people. He got very ill and he said to his attendant Ananda, his great friend, "Let's go to such a place, Kusinara, and that's where I'm going to die. Yeah, that's where I'm going to attain parinirvana." Lots of stories to say about that, but mainly I want to just concentrate on the death scene itself, on the on the last hours of the Buddha, the last hour of the Buddha. And it's a I have it very vividly in my mind, although I don't think I've very often seen paintings, but there's very famous, beautiful Japanese paintings of this scene. And you have the Buddha in the centre in what's called the lion pose, which you can see on the shrine. Actually, I can understand it is a lion's pose. If you look at a lion, they have their head, when they have their head up and lying down, that's what the pose is, really. And it has that kind of sort of strength. He's lying down on a stone couch, which was probably something that had been built there for the elders of a particular village to sit on and sort of hold court, as it were. So he lay down on this couch between two sol trees. So it's always worth remembering that the Buddha was born under a tree, was enlightened under a tree, and died under a tree. Trees and the Buddha sort of go together. Yeah. I have a great love for trees. I don't know any of the names, but I do have a great love for trees. So you have to imagine this elderly man lying between the two sol trees, and around him are all the monks and the nuns. They've all come to see him. Around them are all the villagers from the local villages. Around them is all kinds of other things. So you can, the scene needs to be imagined in a cosmic perspective. So you get all the animals are there. In these pictures you have all these animals there. The elephants come, and all the animal kingdom comes to see him die. And according to legend, all the animals cry. And then there are the sky is full of angels. They call them devas, or different kinds of ranks of angels, different kinds of devas, different kinds of spirits, tree spirits, mud spirits, the spirits of water, the spirits of wind. What you get in this image is, there we are at the centre of the universe, is the Buddha lying on this couch, and the whole of the universe is ranged around him, watching him, yeah? Watching him. It's a very, very beautiful image. Very, very beautiful image. And I mainly just want to explore some of the elements of this last hour. And I'll try and take that. I think there's 9 elements, something like that, that I can find. Some of them I want to dwell on more than others. And I'm doing it again in the way that Subhadramati was saying. I'm doing it to try and see what could the spiritual significance of each of the elements of that last hour for us be. Yeah. And the more I thought about it, the more I think there is spiritual significance in all of it. So the first thing to say is he's lying between these twin sal trees, which are beautiful, tall trees. And these twin sal trees go into an untimely blossom. They blossom suddenly, and petals of the flowers fall down on the Buddha. So he's lying there, dying, in his last hour. And these petals are just falling down on the Buddha. These beautiful falling flowers are just falling on him. It's like, it would be like suddenly having cherry trees now in this snow, and that all the petals of the cherry trees just fall down on the Buddha. You know, that sort of wonderful sort of wind of cherry blossom you sometimes get in spring. I sort of imagine it like that. And the main thing I want to draw out from this, and which is one of my main points, I think, is that I think this symbolises the vertical dimension of life. And I want to try to flesh that out. Before I talk about that, I think it's really interesting the relationship of this to the enlightenment. So the last image for me of falling flowers is the image of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, just about to gain enlightenment. And you get the army of Mara, which are all the negative forces in the universe and in himself, in his own heart, but all the universe, coming to try to kill him. They throw every sort of weapon at him, and those weapons change into flowers and fall at his feet. And I'm very struck by the parallelism of those two flower images. And both images are so deeply resonant that they somehow seem to me to speak of something essential about the nature of reality. They're so memorable, aren't they, somehow, that they must be very deep, I think. And what you've got here is flowers again falling at the Buddha's feet, but no weapons. No weapons. So this means that there's nothing to transform. For the Buddha, the parinirvana doesn't really mean anything. Nothing happens for the Buddha. The action of this scene takes place in everybody else apart from the Buddha. He
The great victory was achieved when he gained enlightenment. There are no weapons left to turn into flowers. All there is falling flowers. There's no transformation for him. I think that's must be the sort of spiritual significance of those flowers, that there's no transformation. It goes back to the enlightenment. But I like to think of it as this vertical dimension, because if you look at the sutra, the Buddha says, in the sutra it says not only are these flowers from the soul trees falling, but mandarava flowers are falling from the sky. Mandarava flowers are supposed to be about the size of a cartwheel. They're these kind of mystical flowers, and they're just pouring down from the sky. And then on top of that, there are all these angels and devas in the sky playing music, throwing down incense and so on. So you have to imagine the whole universe lit up with creatures throwing down flowers on the Buddha. Yeah. And I think this is an exquisite image, more than an image, a symbol for the vertical dimension of life. So I want to try and explain what I mean by that. I was trying to explain it in the group, and I don't know how far I got with it. Anyway, we'll try again. One of the things I was saying when we've introduced the retreat, and that Yonavacha reminded us again, is this imagery of the Buddha being the first chick out of the clutch of eggs. This is a traditional image. It's not one that we've made up. Yeah? And the imagery is one of constriction and contraction, and this completely new world, isn't it? It's going from what you thought was a world to an unimaginably bigger world. So that's the force of the metaphor, really. It's from a world that you take to be the world, our world that we can touch the sides of, as it were, then you break out of that into an unimaginably different one. A chick could never imagine the world outside of the egg. And that's why you need the Buddha tapping out on the outside. Otherwise you will be asleep forever, curled up in our shells forever. And we're so comfortable in the West, it seems even more and more possible to be just curled up in our shell forever. So we need the Buddha to be tapping on the shell. But really it's very similar to Plato's image of the cave. I don't know whether anyone... It's a very, very famous image of Plato, which is that he thought of human life as being like people sitting in a cave with a fire or the light behind them, and their bodies are casting shadows on the walls of the cave, and that you think, or the people passing behind, I can't quite remember the image now, but you think that those shadows are reality, if you see what I mean. That you take those shadows passing across the cave as being how things really are. You know, you write dissertations on one kind of shadow, and this kind, you know, you get promoted as a shadow and all that. You think that those shadows are all that there really are, but of course there's this unimaginable world behind you. Yeah, behind you. It's exactly actually the same image, really, of a belief that the world in front of you is the world, but something much, much bigger being revealed to you. Did you but have the knowledge, mindfulness, the wherewithal to notice? Yeah. So I think of this, therefore, as being the horizontal dimension to life. I think the West is characterized by the vertical dimension to life. Sorry. So I think of that as being the vertical dimension to life. The Plato's image, the first chick out of the clutch, as being the vertical dimension of life, and that the Western world is typified by horizontal proliferation. What we've got, largely speaking, not entirely, but largely speaking, is horizontal proliferation. We get better and better at doing the horizontal. We get more and more gadgets. I was thinking, for instance, of the humble tea. We used to have a tea caddy at home, and now we've gone through a whole range of tea bags, from round ones to cuboid ones, you know, to pyramid ones, and it's just horizontal, isn't it? And so much of the West is horizontal in that way. Just more and more of the same, really. I sort of wonder what kind of shaped tea bag they'll have next. An oblong one, a Christmas cake shaped one, I don't know. Tea bags could keep on proliferating. Yeah? And one of the marks, perhaps, of modern life is a loss of faith in the vertical dimension, a kind of endemic loss of faith in the vertical dimension, which I think Yonavacha really expressed that really wonderfully yesterday. In a certain sense, this talk is supporting that. I think we've broken our bond with nature and with transcendence. We've broken our bond with it. I think we've broken it historically and we've broken it personally. So historically, at least in the West, in the Christian West, at the Reformation, one of the things that happened in the Reformation is you had the destruction of the kingdom of angels. So sometimes you can see in ancient paintings you have human beings and you have rows and rows of angels on top of them, then you have God at the top. I always like those pictures. I still relate to that. That was the early Christian vision of one's place in the universe, is that right on above you was an angel, and an angel above that, ranks and ranks of angels. I think there's 9 different kinds of angels, thrones, principalities, archangels, I can't remember them all. But they go up and up and up, and they get more and more refined as they go up. Yeah, and that all the human being needs to do is go up to the first level, then the next, and the next. So you get a universe where you have this vertical dimension of angels. And one of the things that Luther and the Reformation did is get rid of the angels. They wiped away, Nietzsche talks about, they wiped away the whole horizon. They got this sponge and wiped away the whole horizon. So you no longer had that vertical dimension. You had this horrible distance between you on the earth and God and some incredibly remote place, so that any time you tried to change and grow, you could only fall, because you could never jump that far. Before, all you needed to do was go into the next row of angels. Now you had to leap the abyss, really, the abyss. Yeah. So I think historically we've broken our bond with verticality. Also personally, we've broken the bond with the vertical dimension. We've kind of turned against it. And in fact, I think sometimes we've psychologized it. We've decided that everything the universe, is now inside us and is part of our own personal traumatic history, as if the world with all its universes were really part of our own personal history. And in that sense, I think sometimes we've broken the bond with transcendence. I think particularly we've broken the bond with transcendence. I think that the vertical dimension, in my metaphor of it, includes depths as well as heights. It's that dimension of reality. It's not the day-to-day horizontal dimension of reality that we so easily get addicted to. I think the horizontal is addictive. You can always kind of sort of improve it, but that improvement is never really an improvement. Like, it's been amazing to see the growth of mobile phones into BlackBerries, into iPhones. And it's a sort of improvement, but it's not really an improvement. It's just a proliferation of the same. And we get kind of addicted to that, and we sort of almost think that's going to be a substitute for a vertical dimension. So I think we're more at ease with the depths. We're more at ease at thinking that there is depth to life, but often not very at ease with thinking that there are heights to life. And the great danger of that is if we just have depth to life, particularly psychological depth, we very easily end up with self-absorption. One of the great dangers of depth and the language of depth is the danger of self-absorption. I think that anything that teaches introspection, as Buddhism does, as psychotherapists do, and so on, run the danger of cultivating self-absorption. And it's something that we need to always sort of be wary of, mainly because it makes us unhappy. Self-absorption is one of the primary symptoms of depression. Yeah. So I think without this vertical dimension, we just fall into nihilism. We just fall into thinking that our life is just this sort of race between birth and death, and our life is constantly shadowed by death. We fall into nihilism. We fall into rationalism. We fall into thinking that things are knowable by the reason. We start to have a religion of reason. Some people treat reason as a religious position, as if unless it's reasonable, it can't be true. And that is actually unreasonable. People who think deeply about reason realise its limitations. I was reading a book by Brian McGee called Confessions of a Philosopher, which I very much recommend. And he talks about people being wedded to reason, that they just can't see its limits. Interestingly, in the book, I felt that he couldn't quite see its limits either, even though he could argue it. He was very clear at arguing the limits of reason, but couldn't seem to see beyond it. Yeah. So rationalism is a kind of religion of reason, really. I think losing the vertical dimension means that we easily become cynical, we easily think there's no meaning to life, that actions don't have consequences and so on, and it easily leads to a kind of super-sophisticated cerebral mindset, which I think after a certain point it gets really quite unhealthy. I think what it comes down to is, without the vertical dimension, we really believe that reality is knowable by the mind. That self is knowable, that the world around us is knowable by the mind. And you end up with this kind of smug materialism, as if we actually know. There's a poet that is a very, very good poet, but he writes about... he was writing about Rilke's poetry. And he sort of said, of course, we can just dismiss Rilke's, you know, religious fervor, whatever, you know, just that sort of stuff and nonsense. And you end up with this terribly smug, complacent kind of materialism, I know best. It's actually parochialism, but it's a kind of posh version of it. You just sort of think, oh yes, but those were those poor old people who believed things, but we know better. Do you see what I mean? We're not hoodwinked like them. We end up with this kind of, smug materialism and so on. So I think we do have touches of the vertical dimension. We all do. So the most obvious one is childlike wonder, isn't it? We are born with childlike wonder. It's part of us. We create worlds as a child. I've got this. I've got a three-year-old niece who I very much enjoy playing with. Both of them. I've got two nieces, and she's got this tent in her bedroom, and we go in this tent. And she said, "No, no, Mother Benji, you can't sit there. No, no, Teddy sits there." And we have to get all the teddies sitting in the right place. And no, 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 Teddy sits there. You sit there. I'll sit here. And we heard this sound of somebody coming up the stairs, and she said, she was going, "Is it a monster? Is it a monster?" I said, "I don't know." She said, "Is it a monster?" And she was getting really into it. And then there was a shadow, and said, "It's a monster!" And then she came out and she said, "It's not a monster, it's a daddy!" So she seemed to have this cacophony of a daddy, but it was a daddy, not a monster, luckily. But it was really alive for her. She really was. Is this going to be a monster? And no, luckily it was a daddy. It was a daddy, yeah. So we've all got that childlike wonder, haven't we? I remember myself, you know. And we must not lose it. We must not lose it. One of my favourite sayings is that we need to retain our innocence whilst losing our naivety. Very difficult thing to get right. But if we lose that kind of innocence and childlike wonder, we lose the vertical dimension, really. We lose our natural access to the vertical dimension, and we need to find it back. We need to get it back. If we cannot wonder anymore, we need to start again. We need to go and play again, really. Of course, we can also touch the vertical dimension in beauty, particularly the beauty of landscape. Somebody in my group was saying that a walk he'd had one morning, he said, if that's all that happens on this retreat, it would have been worth coming on this retreat. This sense of landscape, of trees and fields, suddenly becoming more than merely things. They're suddenly lit. Janowicz was saying that somebody was saying seeing a horse in that way. That suddenly things are lit. They're not just themselves anymore. Sometimes I come out of meditation and even the car park seems more than itself. Looking at the trees, it's like nature steps towards you as well as you step towards it, as if it's alive from its side and is interested in you. Those moments of seeing the natural world with heightened significance are a moment of accessing this vertical dimension, and they're moments that we need to really cherish. Interestingly, Brian McGee, the writer I talked about, he talked about being, when a young man, he was on a walk and he was looking at these horses in a field, and he said that it's the only time he's ever experienced timelessness. He said they were kind of moving in a movingless world. He said you just can't describe it, but he was looking at these horses moving in a field, and nothing was moving. So many of us have had something of those kind of experiences. Another place, of course, we can experience it is through art, through the arts. I was telling my group that a good long while ago, I memorised the first, I don't know, however many lines of a poem by Keats called Hyperion. He wrote the poem when his brother was dying of TB. So the poem is it's a wonderful poem, it's one of the great poems of English literature, but it's full of tragedy, although it's never spoken. And I'd been memorising it and, you know, trying to remember the words, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it was all kind of horizontal. I could see that it was beautiful. I could see that yes, it was great, and yes, well, I couldn't understand the pentameter then, but I can now. You know, I could sort of see it was good. Then one day I was sitting in a train going to see a friend of mine in Colchester, and I said the first 10 lines, and I burst out crying. I just wept and wept and wept. It felt like this collection of words that are just on this horizontal dimension, just words on a paper, words that you can find in any conversation, the odd God thrown in for good measure. Just this collection of words and me suddenly putting them together, it was like this door flung open into the vertical dimension. In this way, through tragedy, tragedy can open out that vertical dimension. So often it's around the death of someone, isn't it? Or the breakup of a love affair, where the vertical dimension opens up. And I just wept for the beauty of it and the tragedy of it. And it was like suddenly standing under a rain of flowers. It was like being under the thal trees. We can find it in meditation. We can find it in everything of value. So I like to think of the falling flowers on the Buddha as being an image for the vertical dimension. And we need to get under those flowers. We need to do that urgently. We've got capacities to do that. We just need to keep awakening them. And in a way, that's what a retreat can do. Interestingly, going back to the story, the Buddha's talking about all this very matter-of-factly. He's saying to Ananda, he's saying, yes, well, yes, aha, there's all these flowers falling from the sky, yes, aha, and then the mandara of flowers, and there's these musicians. But he said, this isn't the way to honour the Buddha. This isn't the real way to honour the Buddha. It's very, very striking that, so you've gone right into this mythical world of woo, and you could get a bit sort of flowery in the pejorative sense, but he says, no, that's not the way to honour the Buddha. The way to honour the Buddha is to practice his Dharma. Anyone who practices his Dharma throughout all time, they honour the Buddha. This isn't that important, anyway. So I think he's warning us against mere devotionalism, where you just sort of get all excited about something because it's beautiful, but you don't really do anything about it. You don't actually try to tread the path of the Buddha. You don't try to practice the Dharma. So he's saying that's how you honour the Buddha, is by practicing the Dharma. Completely sane, completely straightforward. Yeah. And the Buddha moves like that again and again between one world and another. So just when you think he's sort of spaced in the world of flowers, he's suddenly saying, tell you what, unless you're being kind, unless you're being mindful, unless you're being honest, you're not really honouring the Buddha at all. Yeah. The next part of the drama that I want to mention is this lovely little moment, which I've never really thought of deeply before, which is, I always thought of it as almost a bit of a joke. So what's happening, this is a picture, in front of the Buddha, there's a monk called Upavana, and he's fanning the Buddha. He's fanning the Buddha, yeah? And the Buddha says, Upavana, could you move out of the way, basically? And Ananda thinks, well, that's very strange, you know, fancy, because Upavana's been this very loyal disciple, and the Buddha's suddenly saying, can you move out of the way? Can you stop that, please? And Ananda asks him, and the Buddha says, well, you see, the universe is full of deities who've come to see me die, and Upavana is standing in their way, they can't see. he says, look, the universe is full of beings. You can't touch a place in the universe with a horse's hair that there isn't a deity. And Upavana is standing in their way, and they're getting irritated. They can't see me. It's a lovely story, like in the middle of this cosmic drama, there seems to be a cosmic joke. But I was thinking about this, and I wonder what we can make of Upavana, because he has his back to the deities. So I wonder whether we can think of Upadana as somebody who has taken the Buddha's teaching as a rational philosophy, who has been a very loyal disciple, who has practiced the Buddha's teaching, but who lacks imagination, who hasn't really caught the spirit of the Buddha's Dharma. He's kind of done the right thing. He's meditated, he's practiced ethics, but a bit like he would be following Aristotle or Socrates. So all he's seeing is an old man who's dying, who's very hot because he's got a fever. So he's fanning him. He doesn't see the cosmic drama that he's involved in. He thinks he's with Socrates. You see what I mean? So I wonder whether Upavana is an image for us when we merely think of the Buddha's Dharma as a kind of another tool in our psychological toolkit or our psychophysiological toolkit, another self-help program, another interesting man who's got wise comments like Marcus Aurelius or someone like that. that we think of Buddhism as something simply human and without any truly transcendental dimension. So it's as if, and it's interesting, he's got his back to the deities, you see. So at times in our Buddhist life, we have our back to our imagination. We have our back to this vertical dimension. Even when we think we're doing the right thing, we've become, as it were, bound by ideology, bound by group values. We're not really exploring anymore. We're just doing the things that we kind of do. And we're doing it in the sense of thinking of the Buddha as a kind of, yeah, impressive man. Yeah. So I slightly wonder that's what might be, why he's in this part of the story. It also links with another character that, again, slightly funny, which is Subhadda. So this takes us to another part of the drama. In a way, this is outside of the drama, but it's a lovely little story. Because after the Buddha dies, they try to lift the Buddha's body, and they can't lift the Buddha's body. And that's because the deities are aware that there's a whole other group of monks coming to see the Buddha, and they're trying to make sure that they don't move the Buddha and burn the body before they arrive, which is very nice of the deities. And then they kind of cut to this group of Buddhas, it's like a film, they cut to this group of monks coming, and most of them are weeping, except for Subhadda, who's saying something like, frankly, I'm glad to be rid of him. It's lovely, because everybody keeps saying, oh, it's terrible, so soon, the Buddha's died so soon. They repeat this refrain, so died so soon, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. And then Subhadda says, yeah, he has died, and frankly, it's about time. He said, and it's very, he basically says, well, you know, he was always telling us to do this, and he's always telling us not to do that. And now we're rid of him, and we can do what we like. Sangharakshita says he's the first individualist in Buddhism. But it's striking, isn't it, that that attitude is right there, right next to the Buddha's Parinirvana. You've got someone saying, well, frankly, you know, he was always telling me what to do, and he's always telling me not to do, and that was really getting on my nerves. So I can now enjoy myself at last, you know. And actually, I think the reason I put this into the story, although it's sort of in the next scene on, is because I think, again, this links with our broken faith with the vertical dimension. We've also lost faith in spiritual hierarchy. We've all lost faith in the idea that other people can be more developed than oneself. We're very worried about that. We're worried about any kind of hierarchy, in many ways reasonably, because hierarchy has so often been destructive and productive. But if we get to the point where we really believe that no one's more developed than I am, that one is, then there's no way we can learn, there's no way we can be receptive. How can we tread the spiritual path? I've been very, very lucky to have close relationships with people that I look up to who are more spiritually developed than I am. I think that's an important place to get to, that people, you know, people who are more spiritually developed than you are. You don't lose your critical faculty, you don't be silly about that, and you don't come to that decision very quickly. The Buddha was even very, very careful about that. He said you needed to know somebody for an awful long time before you could really sense if they're more spiritually developed than you are. But I think we've broken the bond of spiritual hierarchy. We've broken the bond that people could be looked up to. And I think we've got disastrous consequences to that. It's filtered into politics, hasn't it now, though everybody can be dragged down. It seems to be the thing we particularly delight in doing is dragging down people. And we've created this society of openness. But it's not a society that's very stable. Don't get me wrong, I'm not advertising hierarchy as we normally think of it. Usually it's power over, isn't it? Spiritual hierarchy is power to. Power to be kind, power to be generous, power to be wise. Yeah? It's not power over. But just because we're so nervous of power over, we shouldn't destroy power to. If we do that, we won't learn, and we won't gain access to the vertical dimension of life. Looking up to people is a classic example of being in line with the vertical dimension. I remember looking up to my math teacher. Not because I could do maths, I could certainly not, but she was just such a wonderful woman. I had a sense in which she saw me in a way that other teachers didn't, and somehow encouraged me. She seemed to like me and want the best for me, when other teachers had already decided that I wasn't going to be up to much. She somehow communicated that she didn't think that, and I looked up to her, and I still feel grateful to her now. If we lose that, we lose any possibility of genuine spiritual growth, because we always think we know best, which again takes us back to kind of smug materialism. So I think those two parts of the story come together. And gosh, look at the time. Okay. The next little bit that I really enjoy in the sutra is Ananda says to the Buddha, because Ananda's taken a long time in the sutra to come to terms with the Buddha's death. Ananda's been, he's a cousin of the Buddha, but he's really a close friend of the Buddha. He looks after the Buddha, and when the Buddha's ill, it's Ananda that nurses him. You know, these lovely images of Ananda massaging the Buddha's back, because the Buddha had a very painful back at one point, and Ananda massaging, it's a very, very simple human moment. And Ananda's finally come round to, okay, this is the Parinibbana. And he says to the Buddha, you know, why here? Why here? You know, he says something like, please don't die here. This, he calls it a little mud-walled town, a backwater town. So he's saying, you know, for heaven's sake, not here. You know, it's like dying in Solihull or Market Harbour or something like that. You know what I mean? I'm thinking you'd have to imagine the Buddha's Parinibbana just outside Lewisham. And on and just saying, surely we could get on the central line, do you know? Not here. Very interesting little part of the story. And then the Buddha says, oh yes, but you don't realise. Once upon a time, there was a wonderful city here. Once upon a time. There was a king called never mind, what's the name of the country? Never mind, you won't be able to remember anyway. A king, beginning with S, with an A at the end, he created this wonderful city, and he was a righteous king. He was a very good king, many, 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 many moons ago, you know, sort of prehistory. And he created this... excuse me. He created... One wants to look one's best. He created this wonderful city of righteousness, of good people. And the Buddha's implication is that's still having effects now. That the people of this area will come and see me. They're concerned about me. They're concerned about value. It's as if he's saying, yes, but you don't realise there's a tradition of value that's still a bit alive here. Yes, the cities disappeared many millions of years ago, but the influence of value coming from that time is still alive. Yeah? So it's as if the Buddha's saying it's people that's important, not prestige. It's not buildings and capitals and so on. It's people and the influence that people create that's important. And the Buddha can feel that influence. He knows that this is a place in which the death of the Buddha can and should happen, whether it's outside Lewisham or Solihull or wherever it is. Yeah? One of the things that this points to for me is that the Buddha wasn't parochial in time. And I think we often are. I mentioned it before, but we often think we know best, don't we? Which is really just parochialism. We can be parochial in time as well as space. So we tend to think that we're the ones who've got it sorted out, and all of those sort of kind of pre-modern people who kind of believe religious things, we're all much better than them. And that happens in every age. Every age thinks we're the ones who've got it sussed. The others were kind of a bit silly, really, a bit stupid. They weren't educated, they didn't have soap bars or whatever it is. So the Buddha's not parochial in time, and he's not parochial in space. He knows, actually, the real reality of things. So he's not locked into this particular historical moment. We're hypnotised by this historical moment. We take on its values with our mother's milk. We take on all of its values, and we think that there are values. People say, for instance, you know, the importance of thinking for yourself. That idea is somebody else's idea. You didn't come up with it. I didn't come up with it. I can't remember which philosopher it was. But we've just taken it on. We really believe that we do it. Thinking for yourself is very, very rare indeed. Very, very difficult to genuinely do. Everybody thinks they're thinking for themselves, and that's the sort of thing you think nowadays. You see, that's parochialism in time. So the Buddha's beyond that kind of parochialism. He doesn't think that the historical moment he's in, he's not locked in it. He can see a larger perspective. Also, it's linking his death with the decay of the city. So it's a wonderful teaching in itself. There he is dying, a Buddha dying, in a place that was once a wonderful city. So he's saying, just as this. So the where the Buddha gains Parinirvana is part of the what he teaches. Do you see what I mean? The where
of the Buddha's Parinibbana is part of the what he teaches. So he's saying, just as I die, so do golden ages, so do righteous kings, so do cities. This place was once a city. So the very place he's sitting is a teaching about what's happening to him. Very, very striking when you think of it. I like that. I'll go through the last few images a little bit quicker. So the next part of the story is the Buddha's lying there, very close to death, and another man called Subhadra, it's slightly confusing, you've got two of them, but never mind, another man called Subhadra, has heard that the Buddha's there and wants to see him. And he, traditionally, you'd always go up to Ananda, his companion, and say, can I see the Buddha? And Ananda said, really, just really not a good time. Great, that's good that you want to see the Buddha, but this isn't a good time. The Buddha's dying. No, you can't see the Buddha. And Subhadra really, really wants to see him. And he asks again and again. And Ananda, obviously very, very deeply moved by the situation. You're just thinking, well, no, you can't. You can't. You can imagine it, can't you? You just think, no, he's had enough of it. He's been teaching for 40 years. He's always having people wanting to tell him things. He's actually not dying now. Leave him alone. Let him die, And the Buddha overhears Ananda saying this and says, no, Ananda, don't send him away. Bring him to me. Very, very touching moment. Just says, you get this lovely sense of transcendent gentleness in the whole sutra. He just says, no, Ananda, no, don't do that. Bring him to me. Yeah? And they have this conversation, and Subhadra becomes a disciple of the Buddha. So the Buddha has no concern for himself. He's teaching the Dharma right to his last breath, literally. He has no concern for himself because he hasn't got a self to feel concerned about. He overcame that. He saw through that at the Enlightenment. He saw through egotism. The problem of death has already been solved for the Buddha 40 years before. He solved the problem of death 40 years before. Nothing's happening for the Buddha. And nobody else can understand that. You see what I mean? Ananda sees a man dying. The Buddha doesn't see that. He's already seen through what can die. What we really fear is a dissolution of self. But the Buddha's already seen through the self. To go back to Yonavarcha's talk, the Buddha knows about the ocean. He knows about the whirlpool. So there's nothing's changing. It's just a new pattern, So yes, I want to help Subhadra gain that enlightenment for himself. So he's completely not at all concerned about himself. He's exemplary in every way, and he's exemplary in his compassion most particularly. But then you get this lovely, probably the most emotionally dramatic and the most emotionally moving part of the scene, which is that you can imagine this Ananda in the scriptures, you definitely feel him. He's a real person. He's exquisitely sort of kind. He's not at all clever. He just tries to help. He just tries to help. He never shows off. He never gives great Dharma talks. He just tries to do what he can to help. He's always around, saying, I'll hold this. It's a beautiful figure. Bhante once called him the first Bodhisattva of Buddhism, the first being completely devoted to the welfare of others. That's what Ananda does. But there he is, his great friend that he's been living with 25 years all the time is dying, and he just can't bear it anymore. He just can't bear to be there anymore. They've got this assembly, and you can imagine him kind of pushing his way through the monks. And it's said that he's leaning on the door jamb of a house, weeping, just weeping and weeping and weeping, that the Buddha's dying. And I was very struck by this little tiny detail, the door jamb. We've never had any architecture in this sutra before. This is suddenly a tiny, tiny detail, and yet without it you don't get the picture. With that door jamb and him leaning on this door jamb, you can see Ananda weeping and weeping. And what it reminded me of, and I think it does the same in the sutra as it does in this, it reminded me of King Lear. So those of you who don't know the play King Lear, when he's dying, this fabulous, what is terrible and fabulous last scene. Cordelia, his favourite daughter, has just been hung, and he comes onto the stage holding her, completely grief-stricken his whole life. And He says, no life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Thou'st come no more. Never, 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 never. Pray you, undo this button. Thank you. Yeah? Thank you, sir. And it does exactly the same thing, doesn't it? Never, 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 never. Pray you, undo this button. And you don't actually know in the play whether he means his button or her button. He's holding her, so he could mean undo her button so that she can breathe, or undo my button. But the reason it's so deeply affecting in the play is because we all know what it's like to have a tight button around your throat. You just know that feeling. So in the middle of the cosmic drama that is King Lear, which is a cosmic drama, you get this tiny human detail which makes the drama live in a way that it couldn't without him. And one of the things I think this points to is that the cosmic drama of life makes us more human. Bhante Sangharakshita once said that if we try to make somebody more than human, we make them less than human. So that moment of leaning on the door jamb, that tight button, somehow makes the human more. Not more than human, but more human, if you see what I mean. It kind of resonates through the cosmic drama and gives it human significance. And without that significance, and again it's a vertical significance, not a horizontal one, the drama would fail. He's weeping, and what Ananda says is that my master is passing away, he who was so kind. Very, very famous words of Ananda. He who was so kind. Sangharakshita points out he could have said so many other things. He could have said he who was so wise, he who taught so many people, he who converted so many people to the Dharma, he who... Blah, blah, blah. But what he chooses to say, the virtue he most brings out is kindness. He who was so kind. And when we say this, I think we very easily say, oh, how nice. But do we realise the challenge of that, to be so kind? Do we really have a sense of that? I've been thinking more and more about how many excuses we give ourselves for being unkind, for being vengeful, for being angry, for being cruel, for being unthinking, for being mean. We just give ourselves excuses. And I wanted to draw out two particular, I think the two places we often excuse ourselves is in the political realm and in the small things. So one of the things I notice is that there's always in any group something you can be indignant about. Something that you're allowed to be indignant about, in which you can put your hatred. When I was a child, back in Henley and Arden, I remember my family have a coach company, and all the coach drivers used to be there. And they'd often get into these discussions about the IRA. And I remember as a small boy, this sense of hatred filling the room. Nobody knew the first thing about the IRA. Nobody knew anything about what was happening, and they had no intention of finding out either. It was just an excuse to vent hatred, and the kitchen would become poisonous with hatred as people talked about it. I'm not saying anything about the IRA, I don't know anything about them either, but I remember being struck by this is just your hatred, it's nothing to do with the IRA. You don't do that anymore, do you? In every social grouping, there's something you're allowed to be morally indignant about or sentimentally indignant about. And it's usually to do with politics. At the moment, it tends to be things like gender, it tends to be things like cultural studies, it tends to be diversity, all kinds of things, sexuality. Suddenly, those are things that you're allowed to be hateful about. There's lots of other things you're not allowed to be hateful about. But they're just sort of cups in which we can put our own personal hatreds. Hatred is always personal. It's never really anything else. It's always ours. But it's an excuse. We all want an excuse. The other area, I think, is small things, isn't it? Most of us don't really know anything about the big things. People talk about cultural things. I don't know that they actually know. I don't know. But then, you know, somebody doesn't wash up and you go into a rage. You know what I mean? Or somebody leaves a bit of the shower in a bit of a mess, and you feel hugely hard done by. It's the small things, isn't it, that really bite into us. Those small actions that make us flare into indignation, into rage, into anger, into spite, and so on. So This act of kindness that the Buddha, that Ananda remembers, is an act of supreme courage, really. It's the rarest quality. It's nothing like sentimentality, nothing like sentimental kindness. And what we tend to do is say, yes, that's a great quality, and then we keep finding excuses to allow ourselves to be angry. You can do it in every single group you belong to, including a Buddhist group. Yes? You can find something that it's all right to be hateful about. So the Buddha eschewed that. And then the Buddha is very close to death now, and he says, okay, so I'm dying. He doesn't say I'm dying because he's not dying, but he says, okay, here we are together. Any questions? So do any of you have any questions about me, or as the Buddha, or do you have any questions about my teaching? I don't want you, at a later point, to think, I was there and I didn't ask him. I mean, that's what he's saying. He says, I don't want you later in life to think, how ridiculous, I was there with the Buddha in that last moment, I didn't ask him that question, and now I'll never know. So he said, look, I don't want that to happen. Is there any questions? And he asked that three times. He says, you know, and there's this lovely silence. Again, he asks the question. And then he says, okay, I know how it can be. I can know how there's lots of people here. I know the significance of the occasion. You might feel shy to ask a question. You might think it makes you feel silly to ask a question. How about you tell your friend and get them to ask the question? And it's an exquisite level of awareness, isn't it? It's an imagination so deep into the reality of others as to be transcendental. It's a seeing through into people's minds and saying, look, I know what happens. If it's difficult, get somebody else to ask it. And this is right on the moment of death. And then there's no questions. And then the Buddha closes his eyes, and he's described as going up and down the dhyanas. So the dhyanas are superconscious mental states. They start with ordinary consciousness. They go up into the first dhyana, the second dhyana, the third dhyana, fourth dhyana, all the way up to the eighth dhyana, then back down again. So he goes up and down these superconscious mental states. And I think this is the Buddha doing his final tour of the verticality of life. Interestingly, before he dies, he does a final tour. He knows he's going to die. He realizes he's going to die. And what he does then, he does this final tour. He goes and does all this teaching, and teaches the middle way, actually, again and again and again. He teaches what's called the path of regular steps. He goes out, and he teaches even though he's dying. He does this final tour. And it's like these dhyanas are like doing this final tour of the vertical dimension of life. Because he knows it so well, he can just go right up to the eighth dhyana, this super, 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 you know, it's beyond time and space, it's beyond any sort of thought or knowing, and comes back down again, and goes up again, and comes down, and then he leaves from one particular dhyana. It's like he just steps off, like stepping off a boat, he just steps off the dhyanas. It's like he just checks, goes through the whole of the vertical dimension, from the depths to the heights, and then somewhere around the middle, he just sort of steps off. And he steps off the map. And actually, that's where he is anyway. He doesn't really step off the map. It's just his body dies, and nothing's changed for him. There's a parinirvana, the enlightenment without remainder. This transcendental experience without delusion, without any kind of duality. And nothing can be said about this. What happens then, nothing can be said. Nothing can be asserted, nothing can be denied, nothing can be contradicted, nothing can be said about the Buddha at that moment. All we've got is falling flowers. And I like to imagine those flowers falling through the universe, always, always, always falling. Because that's what Buddhism is saying about the nature of reality, is there are always falling flowers. There is a universe, a horizontal universe that we live and die in, and get into terrible states in, and good states in, and succeed and fail in. But then there's this vertical universe raining down flowers all the time. Always, always raining down flowers. And our job in life is to open up to that rain of flowers. I was very struck last night by the snow. We had Yanavacha's really wonderful talk, and then the universe seemed to respond, didn't it? By cascading us with white, by suddenly covering the world in a new dimension. That snow very quickly changed the world into a pristine white place, a pristine place of change. It was like the falling flowers. Yeah? So you can imagine, I think, in this moment, that this whole story ends with silence and flowers falling, falling, falling faintly all the way through the universe. Okay.